Thanks, Miranda. Kia ora tatou, one and all. Welcome to our last monthly midday military history presentation for this year. For those, I see a few new faces in the audience. I'm Joe Hollander. I chair the Parnas North Defence Heritage Advisory Group that co-hosts these presentations with our Engineer Corps Memorial Centre out of Linton Camp and along with the Parnas North City Library. It's my pleasure to welcome back one of our very regular speakers, Peter Wynn, who's going to talk today on island hopping, which is more about the 3rd New Zealand Division in the Pacific during World War II. So without further ado, please welcome Peter.
Good afternoon, everyone. And thank you all for coming along to this. Really pleased to have the opportunity to talk to you all about the 3rd New Zealand Division. The 2nd New Zealand Division was far larger, had a much longer life, and is far more famous. You know, Victoria Crosses, the whole box and dice, poor old 3rd Division. It had a very short life, but it actually did a terrific job. And sadly, we've even had members of the New Zealand Defence Force and the Solomons over recent years, and many of them didn't even know. And I was just talking to a guy on the car on the way here. He's just come back from the Solomons, and they only found out that New Zealanders had been on Guadalcanal just as the mission was closing. But anyway, great to have the opportunity to talk about the division. And there they are, landing under fire. This is the first contested landing New Zealanders have undertaken since 1915. And in the interim, all lessons learned, have been lost. The rapid Japanese advance kind of startled everybody. They thrust very quickly down through Malaya into Singapore and were making their way. You can see the general extent of their advance. And by January 1942, they were already building air bases on Guadalcanal and sort of threatening Fiji, New Caledonia, and certainly New Zealand and Australia's lines of supply were there was the potential for interdiction. But New Zealand was already heavily engaged in Europe. We know the 2nd New Zealand Division was in the Middle East. Many New Zealand aircrew were serving in the Royal Air Force or other RNZAF tasks. Found out earlier this year, we had squadrons flying up in Malaya and Singapore, and so they were already heavily engaged. Leander was in the Mediterranean, you know, Achilles and the armed merchant cruisers Monowai and Hector were undertaking escort duty. So there was quite a naval sort of action going on. But following Pearl Harbor and the Japanese thrust through Malaya, New Zealand's focus became more sharply into the Pacific area. So much so that the Achilles, Monowai and Leander were assigned immediately to a US combined naval task force. And though about two-thirds of our deployed air force remained in Europe, about one-third was actually assigned across to the Americans and fought throughout the Pacific campaign, as I'll mention briefly. So, the Navy. Just highlighting two bits there. They played a significant role in the Pacific. You see on the left there, this is members of the Leander after it's been struck by a Japanese torpedo who are being buried at sea. The ship limped back to New Zealand and was basically out of the water and had to go off to be repaired. And on the right, the little HMS Kiwi rams a Japanese submarine and damages itself, but just two of the actions that take place in and around the area where the division is later going to be operating. The Air Force. These are the current battle honour boards at the Ohakia Base Officers Mess. And they're not very clear there, but you'll see within those two squadrons references to aircraft and to places and locations, battles, air battles during the Pacific campaign. And there we are, proof. RNZAF aircraft flying over Guadalcanal during the war. We had a number of other things I found out this year. We had not only special forces, but the coast watchers. So this gentleman on the left, he got caught up in the Mediterranean doing special operations executive stuff. They bring him back to New Zealand. He doesn't really want to be part of the regular forces, but when they stand up a group to be 4Z or support the Australian 4Z, puts his hand up, gets trained in New Zealand, and unfortunately he's leading a landing at Balikpapan on the coast of Borneo. It would be Indonesia now. He's the landing's compromised and he's missing, believed to be drowned. Or maybe he was captured and killed, we'll never know. But his name is all that's left. The man appears on a lonely large grave, mainly for Australians, and memorial in Borneo. And this young fella, George Edward Carpenter, joined the Navy as a telegrapher, or telegraphist, ends up in the Pacific Islands. There's a big attack on his little lonely outpost by the Japanese, and he gets awarded the Distinguished Service Medal. And that, in this day and age, it's about one or two down from the Victoria Cross. Not a bad effort from a Navy guy, suddenly on shore, and he's really just a telegraphist. So there was a lot of stuff going on. And there's not even a picture of this guy down. So it's a real shame. That's really the only record is in this memorial site there. But there were plenty, and I bring this up at the start because I'm really going to be talking about the division, and therefore principally about the New Zealand Army division, and really mentioning more so the United States Navy and Marine Corps than our own. But this is all going on around the New Zealanders are there. So really, just I'll go through this sort of presentation. There's a couple of bits at the end. To my left, your right, there's some items that have just come in and of interest, and I think we should take a look at those and their current owners. Can perhaps explain the progeny, how they got hold of them and what they represent. But we'll cover those as well. But I'll just go down through this plan there. And so really, Guadalcanal, which is where the division stages from after the Americans have taken it, is down in the circle on the right hand side. And then we're talking about Vella La Vella, which they don't land under fire on, but they clear Treasury Island, or Mono and Stirling, where that photograph of the opening thing is, where they're first under fire. And then Nisan, or the Green Islands, which is held up as an exemplar of amphibious operations. And that was the division's final action. And all of this is driving towards Rabaul, a major Japanese base, which initially was intended to capture, destroy, annihilate, but ended up being to isolate it rather than attack it. So, despite the surprise of the Japanese attack, it comes as no surprise that the British, the Americans and the Japanese all kind of had like Pacific war plans. So the British plan, and some of you might recognise a little snip from the map there of the Singapore naval base and the dockyard and stuff. Their plan, so-called Singapore strategy, was to build this big base on the northern side of Singapore, to Johor Strait, right across from Malaysia or Malaya. And in the event of a war, a British fleet would sail down, and that fleet would then blockade the Japanese, and then they would sort of pick things up from there. And the New Zealanders and the Australians kind of bought into this. It also meant you didn't have to have a large navy, and a lot of it would be done by the British there. But there was an agreement for New Zealand to secure Fiji, Tonga and some other British protectorates. So we actually were going to deploy forces, and did, but they were to places like Fiji initially. The Americans also had a plan. In fact, they had a number of plans. Germany, France, Mexico, China, Cuba. Once talked to an American colonel I knew, his job was he was in charge of war plans. So they still do them. Anyway, Plan Orange was the plan to deal with the Japanese in the event of an invasion. Essentially, Wake Island, Guam, the Philippines were to hold in place, and then launching out of Pearl Harbor Naval Base, they would then basically deal with the Japanese ships, blockade Japan, and then bring the war to kind of a conclusion. That's putting it in very simple terms. So in some respects, the British and the American plans were similar, Pearl Harbor and Singapore. The Japanese, though, they had their own plan, and they realised early on that they couldn't take on the navies of Britain and America, so therefore their plan became a swift strike. So what we now know as Pearl Harbor, that attack to take out the American Navy, but ideally an attack using ground forces, so most of the naval forces could be striking Pearl Harbor to take the Singapore naval base from the north, the landward side, and of course we know now that this is what they did. So they would, they're the basic three plans that were in place. But then of course as the war started, we all assume that the, well, we think that the, some of us, that the Pearl Harbor attack was the day before because it's the 7th, but in fact the landing in Malaya was about 40 minutes prior because there's a dateline in there. So in fact it actually occurred, they occurred on the same day within about 40 minutes of each other, the landings in Kota Baru and Malaya, and the same, and 40 minutes later the first strike at Pearl Harbor. Of course the landings in Malaya and the capture of Singapore are somewhat overshadowed by this, the casualties and the sheer surprise and ferocity of the attack on Pearl Harbor. The Royal Navy sent a much depleted fleet down to Singapore, and that was sunk very quickly. The Repulse and the Prince of Wales, because they didn't have air cover, and pretty much the Japanese were able to expand out of the Pacific, and for a period then, the Americans and the British or the, and the Allies are on the defensive. But one key decision that was taken at the strategic level was that the US would take primacy for the countering the Japanese in the Pacific. The Americans then divided up the Pacific, as they would do. They still do with their CENTCOMs and all that sort of stuff. But anyway, from our perspective, the US Army under General MacArthur had the Southwest Pacific area, and that's predominantly land masses between Australia going all the way up towards the Philippines and stuff like that, so that was deemed more army supported perhaps by Navy and Air Force, whereas the Navy got the Central and South Pacific areas under Admiral Nimitz. And the Central Pacific, but the South Pacific is the area we're most interested in, that went to Vice Admiral Gormley, who was a secretive sort of fellow, and he was pretty reluctant to keep the New Zealand government, our Prime Minister, informed about what was going on, and was initially quite reluctant to use New Zealand forces. But Fraser's government resolved to make a credible military contribution in the Southwest Pacific to ensure, I guess in part, that it not only took part in the defence and then the attacking operations, but also for a place at the peace table. The Cabinet discussed, the New Zealand Cabinet discussed options with the United States Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral King, and it was thought that a New Zealand contingent could train with and work with Marine Corps units and work on amphibious operations. And as we know, talked about previously, a Marine division came to New Zealand and it was based down in the Kapiti Coast there, undertaking training, R&R, and a whole lot of other things. So although Gormley's preference was for New Zealand to defend itself, and he pretty much told Prime Minister Fraser that, Fraser basically bypassed him, went straight to President Roosevelt, and obtained a directive for Commander South Pacific to support the development of a New Zealand division for combat operations. And the US, furthermore, was obliged to supply equipment, etc., etc. Although the issue there is that the New Zealand division is more equipped like a British division in terms of ammunition and all the rest of it. But nevertheless, it meant that the Americans would have to provide sea lift, rations, all that sort of stuff, air support. By August 1942, New Zealand had formally offered the Americans a division and had appointed Major General Howard Barraclough to raise, train and command the division with a strength at this point of up to 20,000 men. And you can see some of the elements that become the 3rd New Zealand Division had already been deployed forward in Fiji, where they'd done training, etc., etc. There's some items from there. And then, very quickly, a Force C a Force A was developed, a kind of Kiwi A, a brigade type group, and an option Kiwi C, a divisional type group. That was selected, and it was deployed to New Caledonia. But as you'll see shortly, it was not quite the full strength division. But it ended up in New Caledonia from December 42 to January 43 for garrisoning, but a lot of training and other duties there. Let's need to talk a little bit about the commander of the division. And he was selected by General Freyberg. Although born in Masterton, Barraclough attended Palmerston North Boys High School from 1907 to 1912. He was renowned for his prowess in debating. He was also a member of the First 15 and a prefect. So there's a direct link to Palmerston North. He served in the New Zealand Expeditionary Force as a lieutenant in World War I, winning the Military Cross and a Croix de Guerre, and very quickly became in the next 4 years a lieutenant colonel, and it was his battalion that was part of the assault on Le Quesnoy in France. So you've got a very brave man with now a legal mind. He goes to the Otago University, gets an LLB, and within a few years he's a full partner in the Russell McVeigh, Bagnall and Mackey law firm. So really sharp dude, and I think it's all this logic, this mind, this debating thing that really, I think, sets up the 3rd New Zealand Division for success. But come the Second World War, he's now a brigade commander, and in that, the ill-fated Greece campaign, he's awarded a Greek MC. He gets a bar to his DSO for his conduct at City Rezeg in 1941. So what you've now got is an officer with modern warfare experience, not from 1914-18 or 16-18 in this case, but modern warfare, brave and really smart, and he's now selected and sent back to New Zealand to be the divisional commander. But when he gets here, they've already had to appoint someone else in his stead. So anyway, as it transpires, the newly appointed commander is killed in an air crash. And so Barraclough takes up the appointment after all, and he's the proponent for 3rd Division, and again in a combat role, not just garrison troops. I need to talk a little bit about this fellow Nanki Bell, the defence attaché, the American guy based in Wellington, but presumably there in New Caledonia with General Barraclough. Just an issue that a point there was going to be another Murray battalion raised, and they were going to help make up the numbers of 3rd Division. The American Halsey, the admiral, supported this idea, and because Barraclough thought, how's this going to work with American troops? Halsey said, no problem. However, it was Nankivell that sort of said, I think that will be a problem. But eventually, the Maori War Effort Parliamentary Committee, so within our own parliament, decided that in fact Maori would be better served that are coming in to reinforce 28th Battalion and other units. So there was never an additional Maori battalion for the 3rd Division, although there was kind of a possibility initially. In fact, it probably made the way for a later Fijian contribution in the Pacific Islands. So the organisation of the division, this is the only ORBAT chart, but it's basically a 2-brigade division. So instead of having 3 brigades, each of 3 infantry battalions, etc., etc., it's kind of skinny down. But it's got a lot of artillery and a lot of anti-aircraft artillery. There's a lot of engineers, Joe, in there, and all sorts of things. And what Barraclough has decided is that actually if you're going to be out there on your own inside an American organisation, you're going to need lots of stuff. And so he was quite, so you could be independent and not reliant on the Americans all the time. And so he got quite a lot of gear. And not shown on there is towards the end of New Zealand Three Divisions campaign, there was a squadron of Valentine tanks that joined in Nisan Island. Right, so rather than, you know, dither, this experienced commander, Barraclough, right, we've got to do the training. New Zealanders haven't fought in the bush slash jungle since the New Zealand Wars. They have to make it up. So he gets ideas from the Australians in Papua New Guinea or New Guinea, the New Guinea campaign, all that's brought across. That exercise in the Kaimais, the objectives are all towns, etc., from New Guinea. They're using Australian SOPs and trying to learn. But the major lessons out of the Kaimais are good things like command and control, the benefits of small unit operations and patrolling, and also the difficulties with radio communications, the need for logistics, engineering, medical. So, you know, Barraclough is continually trying to learn lessons, but at the same time he's weeding out any officer or individual who's not going to cut the mustard, and he's pretty ruthless because you don't want to carry those people forward as they did perhaps when we talked about the New Zealand landing in Samoa when they didn't have the opportunity to cull the wrong people out. This time he's done that. Moreover, when they get to New Caledonia, it's just not for a rest, this is for training, acclimatisation. All soldiers, whether you're a cook, an engineer, or a rifleman, you've got to be able to be fit enough, so there was lots of route marching, heavy packs, so that you got toughened up in the heat, and you could physically carry stuff, because you've got to carry jerry cans, petrol tins off the beach, all that stuff. You've got to be strong, work in the heat, but you had to be able to operate a Tommy gun, throw grenades, because what? If the Japanese come rushing in the night, and you're a cook, you just don't work. So everybody had to learn how to be a soldier, so this is his experience coming through, probably from the First World War, but definitely from the early part of the Second World War. And now you see, here we are in New Caledonia. There's no ship available. They come later. So the HMS Niole, which is named after either the Javanese immigrants who've come to New Caledonia, or possibly from the Niole, and probably from the Niole tree, which is based there. They've made up their own little ship, and they're practicing getting up and down that with all their gear on, which is essential if you're going to be taking part in amphibious operations. They practiced landings in conjunction with US ships, and they sent people off to Australia and elsewhere, even to America, to learn the lessons about jungle warfare, and then they apply that to their own training. So it was really foresighted of the commander. So let's spin it back up a little bit. So while the 3rd Division was spinning up and doing its training, high-level discussions were taking place around the division's future employment. But Operation Cartwheel was the overarching plan, which was to take out the major Japanese base at Rabaul, which is up in here. And essentially, MacArthur's forces, the South West Pacific Army, would sort of approach through New Guinea this way, and the naval forces under Halsey or Nimitz would approach by hopping up the different islands, the idea being to destroy or neutralise Rabaul. But while the operation was getting underway, a quadripartite conference in Quebec in August 43 decided, you know, with Roosevelt, Churchill present, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that in fact, rather than attack Rabaul, they would actually bypass it and make it redundant. And that's how the plan changed, and why it was important, for instance, that islands closer to it that would be captured to become air bases or patrol boat bases or radar stations, so they could support future operations to bypass and neutralise the ball rather than attacking it. So New Zealand's first operation actually didn't involve a landing. They basically embarked on landing craft, but the island had already been, I wouldn't say secured because it had been, but a lodgement had been undertaken by the Americans at the southern part. So this is our first landing against the Japanese, and although it was small and didn't involve a significant amphibious landing despite the ship there, there were a number of much smaller landings at unit level around the islands as the two battalion groups sort of looped their way around to trap the Japanese up the top. The Japanese were defending Column Mangara. That's a little visible in the, that's a major base, so they're bypassing that thing. With a landing on Vella La Vella, and then they were going to establish, as I mentioned earlier, airfields using engineer construction battalions, CBs as I guess we call them. And the Americans did the initial landing, established the lodgement, and then the New Zealanders did the clearing. This is 14 Brigade, while 8 Brigade was stood by for operations on the treasuries, which I'll cover next. Barraclough's instructions were to eliminate all Japanese forces on the island so that we could establish radars on the northeast and northwest coast, and also MPV patrol boat type base as well. The way it was done, essentially the Americans have landed down the bottom and secured that area here. The New Zealanders land on several of the beaches here, non-contested, and then in different groups they make their way around and do a number of landings, trapping the Japanese up the top. They're ready to attack them, but starting with a bombardment. The 3,700 New Zealanders landed, and you saw from that earlier picture, in a range of landing ship tanks, the fast destroyer boats, landing craft infantry, escorted to the location by 11 United States Navy destroyers. They landed on the beach unopposed, established themselves, and then departed. Essentially the 35th Battalion Combat Team, so just not just the infantry. The plan of Barraclough is that when a brigade or battalion goes, it takes some artillery, some mortars, some engineers, some logistics, some medical, so that it can be self-supporting. So one group, the 35th, is going around to the left, and the 37th combat team around to the east or the right to trap the Japanese at the top. The operation takes 10 days. There's lots of hard fighting, sometimes at close range, counterattacks, all that sort of stuff. And in a series of small hops, they finally make it to the top of the island. They have trapped the Japanese. They give it a big bombardment overnight, ready for an attack in the morning. But what's happened is the Japanese have come forward with boats, submarines, patrol, and actually taken the Japanese off the island, about 589 people, and they are now sent up to Buin on Bougainville. So, unfortunately, the Japanese got away. I think the Americans blame the New Zealanders for not attacking them, and the New Zealanders blame the Americans for not blockading them, so I don't know. Whatever it was, they did get away. But the good thing about it was, and there were casualties, of course, I mean, 47 dead and 36 wounded is quite significant for a short operation, but it gave everybody a sense of how things were going to be done in the bush. So it was not an easy entry, but it was a pretty reasonable one that they were faced with, and they did a good job there. So there's only a short pause, and then the other brigade is part of Operation Good Time. And I like this picture because, you know, we're talking lots of big ships here, and it's not just a case like on an inter-island ferry of just driving your car on and then going up to the passenger deck. They've got to work out where stuff's got to go. So the people in the assault troops have got to be spread across all the forward assaulting craft, so they all land together. You've got to be able to get off bigger ships onto landing craft. There's a lot of stores. They've got to be organised. Do you prioritise artillery over bulldozers or over ammunition supplies? All this has got to be thought about in advance, so everybody knows on which ship, what people, what stores, what vehicles are going, so that when you get to the other end, it's not a big shemozzle on the beach. And half the fight in an amphibious operation is the planning that's done beforehand, so that when you get there, you can actually get off the beach real quick and then get onto operations. So the intention for this operation was to secure Mono and Stirling Islands, which make up the Treasury Group, to establish a radar station on Mono and to use Stirling Island as a base for further operations against the 24,000 or so Japanese who were thought to be on Bougainville and nearby islands. And the radar was essential to provide early warning against the Japanese, so you needed to get them out there quickly. Barrow Clough had been advised of the operation on about the 20th of September, so he's got about 5 weeks to set this thing up. He doesn't have all the craft that he would like to do it, but this is going to be the first assault landing since Gallipoli. And given that he doesn't have enough ships, and everything that's required, there's a lot of precise planning undertaken, and that's almost some of the key stuff that's been lost in the interval now. How you do that? How you do that with a whole bunch of Americans too? So and around your own stuff. So they've got to get everything, fuel, ammunition, rations ashore, and decide which troops need to be on which ships, which wave of the assault. So we're talking about 6,500 troops here. 4,500 of them are Americans, the other 2,000, 4,500 are New Zealanders, the other 2,000 or so are Americans. But only about 4,000 can be part of the first wave. So there's a considerable amount of planning goes on. And again, it's pretty much like Villa La Vela. This time, what they want to do is put two battalions into the Blanche Harbour here and then secure the area to the two battalions in the harbour, and then another group is going to come down and secure Stirling Island, and from Stirling Island they'll be able to provide artillery support to the rest of the thing there, and meanwhile another group is going to zip round to the top, capture Soantalu, and there they're going to establish the radar simple. So that's kind of like the outline plan. 0 hour is 06:06 on the 27th of October. It's all going to be timed to precision because you're working with aircraft and all that sort of stuff. Resistance to the initial landing was light, so there was some. And quickly overcome. In one incident, a concealed Japanese machine gun post opened up, and an American CB who got a bulldozer out, just up with the blade, charged that thing and crushed the machine gun post underneath, so there you go. Engineers up front, joke. The Japanese kind of reorganised themselves as they do, bombarded the beach with mortar fire, and it's probably why one of their landing craft infantry, with 299 men on board and 15 tonnes of cargo, was able to be offloaded in 14 minutes. So, this is it, isn't it? You've got to be so organised, and people have got to know their role, what they're doing, covering the beach, clearing it of enemy, getting off the stores, all that sort of stuff. Because if you've got a whole lot of stores and you can't find the ammunition or something, or the Japanese aircraft appear, you're in trouble. So it was very well done there. And then the Stirling Island force was unopposed down to the south. And then a flag was raised on the island about the 1st of November. But it wasn't until the 12th of November that, in fact, the island was clear of opposition. There were a lot of contacts and fights along the way with Japanese forces holding out, and they had to be winkled out of caves and out of the forest by patrols. So, and we believe about 213 Japanese were killed and about 8 were wounded. That's probably also the prisoner count. So it's kind of fight to the death type stuff there. But it was extremely well done. So this is another level up in terms of complexity to the Villa La Vela operation. But there's some good signs. The next operation is going to be the Nisan or Green Islands. And because they didn't have enough information, Barrow Clough decided that there was going to be a reconnaissance. So he wanted to get a battalion up onto the Nisan Islands in advance, so as not to tip off the Japanese that they would later come back with an assault force and capture the place. They dressed it up as a kind of a raid. And you can see them camouflaging up there. Watch this. Okay, so they've camouflaged up. They've got camouflage uniforms now. And what they do is, in a rifle section that might have 9 or 10, you take out 3 riflemen and you maybe replace them with 3 engineers. And they're going to look at beach landings. Another group might go and have a look at where the airfield's going to go and see if the soil or the coral or something's good enough for that. Communications people might be replace a few more riflemen, and they'll go off to the potential site of the divisional headquarters to see if you can get communications. Some people are going to go out and find the locals. Where are they? So all this stuff was planned in advance, and then, as you'll see later on, detailed maps and information was gleaned to set up the main operation. So this came under the name Operation Square Peg. This was the reconnaissance stage of it. Square Peg was the division's final operation, and as I mentioned earlier, held up later as an exemplar. The Green Islands consisted of a number of small coral atolls, with Nisan Island being the main one and the target of this particular operation. The landing force deployed from Vella Novella and consisted mainly of 14 Brigade. The Japanese had at least 80 army people, a number of naval staff, possibly about 120 defenders by the time the island had been reinforced by patrol boat or submarine occasionally. They did the reconnaissance on the 9th, 30, 31 January, and that gave them sufficient information to set up the raid. Including, they successfully got in touch with local people to find out and get from them information about what the Japanese were up to and where they were. The New Zealand forces were transported aboard United States Navy APD, so they're basically destroyers converted into fast troop ships. A number of transports, about 30 transport ships in all, escorted by 18 cruisers and destroyers just as well. The Japanese located the convoy it was departing, and then overnight they kept 8 aircraft on station throughout the night, basically trying to sink ships, and then in the morning there was a big raid. Only 2 ships were slightly damaged, and they shot down at least 8 or 10 of the Japanese aircraft. 12 Japanese aircraft were shot down. Nisan Island, so you can see that there. So essentially the plan that was developed was to bring the assault force through the little gap there, and then they would make it a main landing on here where the airstrip was later to be built and secure that area. And of course you want to secure the entry and exit point there. And then once they were secured, a battalion group was going to come down and clear this way, another battalion group come up this way and do a clearance, and then the CVs were just going to go into construction mode and turn this thing into an airfield. So a fairly simple plan, and based on reliable intelligence. So what could have been, was still complicated, but very much a whole series of unknowns. I mean, could you get into the lagoon? Would you be able to land opposite the Tanglagan plantation, or were you going to be grounded somewhere in mid-water, or were there obstacles along the way? Would you get, as was found on Borneo, to where you want to put the airstrip, only to find it's a bog? So all this stuff had been answered, and this meant that the operation was pretty successful. By the day's end, 58 jeeps, 67 trucks, 44 guns being filled in anti-aircraft, 7 tractors, 8 bulldozers, 10 radars, 8 Valentine tanks, 426 tonnes of petrol and cans, 267 tonnes of rations, and all the troops were landed. So this is a precision operation, just getting all this stuff straight out into the Tangalang plantation area down there and securing it. Part of the air cover for the operation was provided by 14 and 18 squadrons RNZAF, flying in multi-aircraft sorties continuously over the island from sunset to sunrise to sunset. And then that night, after on the night of the 15th, the Japanese again raided by aircraft from Mobile, and then they got the area secured, and there was a lot of firing by the New Zealanders, but mostly it was at marauding pigs rather than at Japanese, because at that stage there was no sign of the garrison. But they did spark up. Oh, and just to give you an idea, I mean, this is the wave. So this is the number of ships, the number of people, and the tons of supplies. This is a massive logistics as well as technical and operational thing there. So people who can plan and do the numbers highly value your planning teams. So Nissan Islands, in the morning from the plantation there, the patrols pushed out, 37 going north, 35 battalion to the south. Each battalion group is supported by a troop of Valentine tanks, which can provide direct fire support, but also, even better, they can crush tracks through the bush, and then you can follow up more easily with all the other sort of stuff that you need. 30 battalion also had a number of clashes, and a party of 70 Japanese was encountered down on the southern part of the island, and they were cleared out. And another group were located and cleared off on the island of Sao. So there's another island up here going up, and a whole lot of Japanese had sort of taken off to there. That was also cleared by the New Zealanders. From the 20th of February, once the island was declared clear, work began to construct airfields. It was mainly undertaken by the Seabees, but the New Zealand engineers and pretty much everybody else as labourers and support. And within 2 weeks, they had a 1,500-metre runway operating with a second smaller bomber airstrip ready to go 2 weeks after that. So that's a massive effort to get two runways under action there. And whilst the New Zealanders did fly off there, they often would land during other missions to refuel on the way out or the way back. So there's a link into the RNZAF. And there is a story in there where I think it's Lieutenant Nixon, to be the US President, was commanding a logistics element and was at one time under the command of the New Zealanders there. Little did they know that this Navy Lieutenant logistician was going to be a president one day. Anyway, such are the coincidences there. These are great pictures. You can see there our own aircraft lined up on the air thing there. That's the two airfields that were built. There's some of the mortar crews firing, and we've got the different commanders consulting there. And very much that now soft hat jungle type thing. And that those kind of uniforms, you know, pretty much even today. Except we don't have to paint our own camouflage anymore. They print that in. But this was really the high point. You know, the casualties don't do much about the intensity of it all. They don't suggest it was such a big affair, but it really was a major operation and extremely well done. And a lot of the planning, and you'll see some of it later in the maps, of that contributed to the success of the operation, but also the way that the US Navy in particular and the Landing Brigade and Divisional Headquarters cooperated was essential. While all this was going on, New Zealand faced its own issues. It's got a manpower crisis. It now needs to reinforce the 2nd New Zealand Division. You think of it, you know, El Alamein's completed, North Africa's been cleared, but all of a sudden we're in Italy. So you've got it, and the furlough drafts have started, so you suddenly need to send a whole lot more people up to the Mediterranean. You've still got to reinforce our 3rd New Zealand Division, but significantly you've got to meet your own industrial New Zealand and agricultural requirements, because we're still feeding the rest of the empire there. New Zealand government consults with the US and UK governments. It's decided that the New Zealand contribution to the Middle East is the main thing, and so pretty rapidly the division downsizes. It withdraws back to New Caledonia, comes back to New Zealand, and is finally disbanded in August. And about 4,000 of its veterans make their way across to Italy. What struck me with this is the sheer quantity of vehicles and stuff that they had. You know, they even discount the stores. Just to wrap up, a lot of casualties. All those that could be found are at the Burrail Cemetery in New Caledonia. Quite a lot of casualties, including fatal non-battle casualties from tropical diseases, vehicle accidents, those sorts of things. And tropical operations, the medical side of it, if you don't get on top of it with malaria, that can take out quite a lot of people. So just a couple of observations. I would say the whole imperative to set up the division was really quite a political one, and it basically redirected a lot of the efforts of the New Zealanders to kind of split them. But from basically nothing other than a couple of brigades, Barraclough, by sheer force of will, established a division, went for a combat role, and really the idea of training and everybody a soldier made quite the difference. Heavy reliance, as we even do today, on our allies, so in this case the United States Navy, Marine Corps and the United States Army Air Force. The importance of training, and fitness for everyone, planning and logistics, and also weeding out of the non-performers. A quick word on Barraclough. He went on to become New Zealand's Chief Justice, Privy Councillor, and was made a KCMG. Tiara, Dictionary of New Zealand Biography, notes that he rose to prominent positions in two unrelated fields, being military and legal. He was one of New Zealand's greatest citizen soldiers who believed that bearing arms in defence of the state was a duty and a privilege. And I believe 3 New Zealand Division and New Zealand generally were very lucky to have him in command. It's not much to remember them by. The original histories, the Pacific campaign and those little slim books on the battalions. More recently, Reg Newell has published a few good books, and the Staff College Barracks is Rabaul Barracks. Quite possibly many of the Staff College students were completely oblivious to the campaign for which their barracks were named. Right, I'll just leave it there. I'm conscious of time, we want to have a couple of minutes here. Any quick questions, and then we'll have maybe Pete and Nick can just quickly cover these off.
Any questions of Peter? What about the carpenter, the coast watcher you mentioned at the start?
Well, I looked up on the thing, he came back, he died fairly old age, and like Havelock Wharf and the thing there. I think he just went back to the railways where he was a telegrapher. Yeah. And, you know, there's nothing written up about the guy.
So the Japanese didn't flush him out of the jungle?
No, they survived, yeah. And no, he wasn't captured. Not that I'm aware.
Not a question, but just a comment. My father was in the 3rd Division, and he would never ever talk about what happened. But the one thing he would talk about, he was very lucky. He went with a Cape mate of his. They were getting off the ship, going into landing craft, coming down the nets before they even had any combat, and his mate fell off the net down to the landing craft and killed himself.
Yeah, that happens even in training, you know. And we had a recent Special Forces death off a helicopter falling. That's why it's really important to learn to climb, ascend and descend with all your gear on. Yeah, but you're right. Get a bit of motion in the sea and on the boat if you're blown, and down you go and you're dead carrying that sort of load. Yeah, a lot of training accidents, a lot of accidents even on operations. Heavy machinery, heights, ships, yeah. Okay, well, what we maybe just go to this, and we'll, if there's any questions, I can take those as well.
Thanks, Peter. We've just got a couple of items. Perhaps Peter, not a Peter, we've got so many Peters here today. Peter Hurley, Peter. Our RSA president here at Harvest North, has got some very interesting items here. Peter, perhaps you would like to explain these, and if people are interested, while you're standing over them and supervising.
All right, well, thank you. And great, Peter, thanks for that. You won't be at the mic, okay. I've got this funny hobby of collecting military memorabilia, and my wife tells me, I say it's preservation, my wife says it's hoarding. I say it's also an investment. But anyway, a few years ago, I saw a map case advertised at an auction, and it just said World War II map case with a map inside or something. So I thought, oh well, I'll bid for it. When I got it, I was really quite surprised. So I opened it up, the old map case. I opened it up, and inside is the map of Nissen Island with the Chinagraph impression over it. And further inside were two subsidiary maps, the Tangalan plantation, as mentioned, and the, I don't know how you pronounce it, Pokinian plantation. So those were there. And a little aide memoir on technical problems. And fascinatingly, a message pad, which is no different from what's being used today, but inside in pencil. I've got to find the pages because... Anyway, inside in pencil, and I'll open it up, is a kind of daily record, sit rep, D-Day going through to D-Day plus five. We suspect, we don't know who this was, probably a signaller, and but there's the fascinating account of every day, basically. And then just lastly, I actually did find a little book which covers what Peter has been talking about now, which is with the 3rd New Zealand Division in the through the Solomons. So I just thought that would be interesting to have a look at and supplement Peter's talk, which was a great talk. Thanks.
Thanks, Peter. Yeah, get an opportunity after we're finished to come and have a look at these items. And then the other item we've got here, Stu, do you want to come and Stuart Schwartz has actually got a painting here. And oh, just stand at the mic, Stu.
I'll stand at the mic?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me get my information.
Yeah.
Thanks. Many of you know that I'm a collector of Kiwiana. We have a virtual museum called the Schwartzonian Museum of Kiwiana. I saw this painting at an op shop on Rangitiki Street a number of years ago, and I said to myself, this is the kind of thing we should be putting into the collection. I purchased it, and the library here helped me with the research. And what we're looking at is a painting done in 1969 by Alan Gardner Hancock, who was born in 1920, died in 2002. And the painting basically was made from notes and sketches that he had made while at Gill's Plantation on Vella Lavella in the Solomon Islands while he was a trooper. I cannot find... Well, within the family, I think those sort of things were destroyed and tried to be forgotten when they gave this painting to an op shop. But this fellow was stationed at Gill's Plantation from December 43 to January 44 and made notes and sketches that resulted in this painting in 1969. And... yeah, I was just pleased to have it and to share it with you all.
Thanks, Wes. Right, well, I'll just leave that here. And as I say, you can come and have a closer look when we're finished. Any sort of final questions that you want to ask of Peter in particular, because you can have a chat to our two gentlemen presenters at their information. But any more questions that you want of Peter?
Not Stuart. Not a question, but just another bit of information. And those of you who went to Boys High will remember the program they have there for excellence, the Barakoff program. Mm-hmm. Still
running.
Still run today.
Yeah. Yep, that's right. Stuart.
Yeah, just wondering, the photo you had at the beginning where you said they were landing under fire, what was the photographer doing with his back to the camera?
Yeah, anyway.
Any other questions? No? All right. Well, look, I'd also like to take this opportunity to particularly thank Peter Wood, who's given quite a number of military presentations to us over the years. Peter has just retired from the New Zealand Army after 49 years of continuous service, which is quite a track record. And on your behalf, I'd just like to present Peter with a little something for his collection and his trouble.
Now, there's something that not everybody has, but there's... All right, thank you very much.